name is Jonathan Katz, and now I've begun to curate what I think will be a series of national exhibitions that are an attempt to end the blacklist on sexuality that's been in place since 1989 with the Robert Mapplethorpe exhibition at the Corcoran. But I come at this having effectively become an art historian that same year, 1989. That was the year that I sort of finished my graduate work. And so it was a very rough time to begin to do a queer project. And so for several years after, well, I think 88 is when I started this. So several years after that, I was doing mostly political activism and started an organization with several friends in San Francisco called Queer Nation, and did Queer Nation for many, many years. And then the Queer Caucus, the College Art Association, and, something called the Lesbian and Gay Town Meeting, and another organization called Harvey Milk Institute, all of which were sort of queer, nonprofit, education-based social change endeavors. And so this seems to be the latest, and of course the stage is a little bit more interesting now because it is, in fact, not specifically a queer stage. And so in some sense, my trajectory follows what I take to be a larger trajectory of queer politics in America, whereas once I was doing LGBTQ-specific political engagements, now I'm seeking to articulate queerness within the most potent metaphors of dominant culture.
How do you queer American art history when the filter has been so dominantly heterosexual, yeah, and perhaps one of silence?
It's such a strange moment in our field because, you know, recently the Museum of Modern Art bought David Wojnarowicz's Fire in My Belly, the very video that was excised from my exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery. And somebody from the New York Times called me and said, you know, what do you think of this acquisition? And I remember several things, one of which was that the Museum of Modern Art wasn't interested in my exhibition. In fact, wasn't interested in doing anything queer at all. So I was struck by the fact that, and said, you know, there's no shortage of queer artists in the Museum of Modern Art. On the contrary, right? What there is a shortage of queer discursive frames. And until there's a greater acknowledgement of the discursive import of sexuality, we're going to be in the same boat. It doesn't matter how many works by queer artists they buy. It's also the case that because of this reign of silence, we've actually falsified American art history. There was an exhibition on Rauschenberg's combines. And in one of the combines, there's a love letter from Jasper Johns to Robert Rauschenberg. Unable to articulate that that was a love letter, the catalog tells us that it was done by Rauschenberg's baby son, Christopher, and thus was an emblem of paternal love, not erotic love. Well, Christopher, as the author of the essay surely knew, was less than 2 years old at that time. So there's no way that Christopher would have done that, and he knew that. And he wrote it anyway so as to avoid, right, any imputation. So, I mean, it's been very difficult. I've been thrown out of two museums, the Metropolitan Museum of Art and the Guggenheim, for raising questions about sexuality.
So are you saying that there has been a self-conscious effort to erase themes of sexuality from art history?
Yeah, I mean, it's been policed. It's not just self-conscious, it's aggressively policed. And when, for example, Robert Rauschenberg at a retrospective in 1995 was scheduled to give an address to an audience, I secured press credentials so that I could be in attendance because I knew that otherwise I wouldn't be allowed in. So I reviewed it for the Village Voice and I got my press card and I go into the room and I'm sitting down. And shortly thereafter, someone comes up to me and says, you know, Mr. Katz, please come with me, a security guard. And I go, what's this about? I'm afraid you're going to have to leave. And I called the curator of the exhibition, who is somebody I knew. And I said, Susan, what's going on? And she said, you know, submit your questions to me in writing 48 hours in advance. And then if we approve them, we'll pass them on to Rauschenberg.
And this policing is institutionally based or is also by the artist?
I think it's done in the name of the artist, but there's a beautiful convergence between their ascription of the artist's own ideas or investments and, of course, the museum's. And the museum wouldn't be doing this if it didn't also serve their purposes. And it clearly does.
How does your project begin? How do you start to think of a queering of American art history? Where does it start?
Well, I think what one has to begin by doing is getting rid of the idea that gay is a biographical category, that is the only way we can talk about this. I certainly do talk about gay artists, but I also talk about artists like Thomas Eakins who antedate the category. And I certainly don't want to be constrained in what can be addressed by virtue of the historical, as yet, right, non-formation or non-existence of gayness. But more to the point, I think the way one has to begin this is by recognizing that the genius of being an art historian as opposed to a scholar of literary or other textual material is that pictures can say things that written materials can't, because you have to employ words, and words carry political significance and often legal weight. But pictures can do things, can evade. You can notice things in a picture or not notice them. You can make something available to one audience while excluding another. Pictures have the ability to articulate a scene in a number of different social and political registers. And so we have this extraordinary archive of queer American history and queer art history that we've never thought to look at, precisely because we've never approached it in this way.
That stems from what I would call the tyranny of American morality, in a sense. Is it like a parallel narrative that conditions the way that we think of art?
It is. I mean, there's several things at work here. You know, people are saying, well, it's the artists. Well, no, it's not, because Eakins is dead a long time, and the Metropolitan Museum did an Eakins retrospective and not only erased 25 years of queer studies scholarship from the exhibition wall labels, but they erased it from the catalog. They excised queer studies from the bibliography in the back of the catalog. So in that sense, it is an aggressive wiping away, and it comes from several things. But I don't actually think that American moral prescriptions are at the top of the list. I think what's at the top of the list is money. We used to have an idea of the museum as in the service of the public interest, and a notion of the public that the museum was in some sense trying to, I mean, it was a patronizing notion, but the museum was trying to elevate, right, the public through exposure to culture. Well, however patronizing, that 19th century model is no longer, because what's happened in museums over the last 25 years, and we have not said a word about this, is that museums have become an extension of private capital. And we see this most readily in the case of LA MoCA, when after financial problems, right, a major donor steps in and dictates the terms under which the museum is going to reinvigorate itself, including the selection of a new director who's now an art dealer. And so the process comes full circle. Collectors are telling museums to hire dealers as directors. I'm nervous. And that's because we effectively have high-value commodities, essentially the focus of our forms of inquiry. Market forces mitigate against the discussion of sexuality. Ellsworth Kelly put it to me as follows. He said, if people find out I was queer, it's going to hurt my prices. Mm. Now, if Ellsworth Kelly is worried about his prices and what the imputation of his queerness would do, tells you a little something.
Because a hint of sexual orientation in the work would demystify, especially in pre-modern and modernism, the idea that art is based on a kind of technical mastery as opposed to anything that has to do with
the body?
With the body? Or?
I think in part, but I think also because one wants to understand works of art as created for the viewer. There's a presumption, right, that work's meaning, it's, you know, we now, through postmodernism, are well aware of the operations of readerly readings. And art history tends to be very much, right, invested in this idea that the work of art can be decoded or read by the viewer or by anybody. That's why modern art is always subject to, of course, certain forms of popular social sanction, because we expect that the work will simply deliver. It's supposed to just mean to me, without regard to what I know or how much of art history I'm invested in. In that process, where the work of art is essentially supposed to be transparently available to me, queerness is very much, right, something that removes, restructures, and reorients the work so that all of a sudden it's not about me at all. And I think that's part of the problem. But I also want to stress something else, which is that art has been held hostage by a culture war that is not really ultimately interested in art. I mean, in fact, what happened with my exhibition isn't really about art at all. In some broadest sense, it's not even about queerness at all. It's about raw American politics and feeding us as raw meat to their minions. And that's what they do. And it's been a strategy that they've engaged since before McCarthyism. But it's the right-wing divide-and-conquer strategy. The best enemy, of course, always being an enemy within. Because if the enemy is within, then you can solidify your authority by policing a group within your own sphere. Mm. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to police. There will be show trials. They will make comments about us that will feed their base. And you've noticed, doubtless, that even the most progressive folks on Capitol Hill haven't raised an objection, have not come to the defense of art. This you'd think would be handed to them on a silver platter. My God, the fucking Republican Congress reads the Constitution of the United States at the opening of the first Republican Congress and then abrogates it by talking about, right, the end of freedom of speech and the end of a separation of church and state in the context of my exhibition. And nobody says a word.
I was interested in the chapters in which you divided the exhibition, and I was wondering if you could, in a way, touch briefly in each one of these chapters and identify what you would consider the most important issues concerning these periods, perhaps exemplifying it by the work of one or two artists.
The show begins with Before Difference, and what I really want to do broadly with the exhibition as a whole was to in some sense abrogate the arrogance of the present. And the arrogance of the present is the assumption, right, that the past looks like us. That if we look hard enough, we'll see ourselves reflected somewhere back there. But in fact, of course, the past is very different. And one of the things that makes the past different to people is to show them something that they can't believe existed in 1950. And that's what I sought to do in my exhibition. So one of the earliest works that I take is some sense of a kind of Rosetta Stone of the exhibition is a print called Shower Bath No. 1 by George Bellows, who is, to all we know, not ever involved with men. But it makes a homoerotic counter front and center. It has a stereotypical queen thrusting his buttocks back, looking lasciviously over his shoulder at a very much butcher man who actually has a towel-covered erection. And it's there, right in the middle. There's no avoiding it. And it's a scene of a shower bath with a number of other naked men all around it. And it dates from 1917. And I looked at this and I thought, my God, how come we don't see mass marketed images of same-sex desire today? But in 1917, this was fine, because not only was this print done once, it was made into an edition three different times. So sold out, was remade, sold out, and was remade. And it wasn't made, of course, as a painting would be for one collector who was sort of predisposed to like this material. It was for the open market. And so that began to get me to think about what that world looked like. And what that world looked like, of course, was that sexual desire, as we understand it today, is premised upon the gender of the person with whom you are having sex. Your sexuality depends on the gender of your sexual partner. But in the period in question, it was rather the gender you took on in the sex act. So if you were behaving in accordance with the dictates of your gender, if you were a man and you were fucking, you could sleep with men all you wanted, and you wouldn't be queer, because you were behaving masculinely. Of course, the converse was equally true. And the ramifications of this are profound, because it suggests the degree to which one could not, as we would today, build a Chelsea, a gay ghetto, a political movement, forms of exclusive and essentializing identity were paradoxically unhelpful and unfruitful, precisely because they led you away from the straight men who were the reason you were declaring yourself queer in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So necessarily queer and straight culture were interwoven at that moment. And an artist like Bellows, who is interested in the social margins, people of color, immigrants, queers, would have surely counted on the fact that people had recognized and had seen similar homoerotic encounters at the bathhouses. This was, of course, at a moment when many people bathed in public bathhouses anyway. They'd seen them. They knew that they existed. And so there was a greater visibility and discursive presence to homosexuality in 1917 than in some respects there is today.
Also, perhaps because the category of homosexuality was not as sedimented as it is today.
Absolutely. In fact, right, again, only one person in that homoerotic dyad was a queer. So you really didn't have the notion of homosexuality. You had homosexual acts, and you had inclinations, but what would two queers do together? I mean, they couldn't sleep together. In fact, one of the great insults was, if you were queer, that I could top you. Meaning, I'm a femme, but you, my God, I could even top you. So in that context, and this is really what I sought to do with the exhibition, is I wanted to explore the degree to which America had not yet cleaved queerness away from its own self-definition. That queerness was part of America, as this man was at the bathhouse. And, there's another image from the exhibition, an advertisement for a record called Prove It On Me Blues by one of the founding greats of Ma Rainey. And Ma Rainey, widely known to be a lesbian, a butch number, in 1925 was arrested for holding an orgy in her apartment. Apparently the women were screaming too loud for her neighbors. And they escaped, but Ma Rainey, who was a large woman, fell down the fire escape and got busted. And 3 years later, she releases a record called Prove It On Me Blues, in which the lyrics are, they say I do it, ain't nobody caught me, y'all gotta prove it on me. And then she goes on to say, yes, it's true, I wear a collar and a tie. Yes, it's true, I don't like men. Yes, it's true. In other words, she lists all the characteristics of lesbianism, but she says, but y'all gotta prove it on me. And the record album and the record advertisement, which is what is in my exhibition, shows Ma Rainey chatting up two very beautiful, svelte young black women while two cops are looking at Ma. Mm. So she's made the whole incident that everybody knew, not just discursively part of the process of the music, but she's using it literally to sell records in the way that Madonna would.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a very different social world. And I wanted to get people to understand how profoundly queerness was part of America once upon a time.
There was absolutely no discursive arena around this time that addressed issues of sexuality in relationship to work.
There was a discursive arena. What it was that, there were queers, and it wasn't necessarily a good term, and you would be arrested if you were flagrantly, or if there was a police endeavor to round people up. But at the same time, places like Bryant Park were widely, universally known to be gay cruising grounds in New York. Everybody knew about Bryant Park. And every once in a while, so ritually, the police would clean up Bryant Park and bust everybody, but it went back. The point I'm trying to make is that in this period in which there wasn't yet a coherent or cohesive homosexual community or identity, there was also concomitantly not a desire to separate out the homos from the rest of us. And that paradoxically made for a world in which there was much greater acceptance of diversity and recognition of diversity on an individual basis than we would see today. People didn't react strangely to the idea that there were queers among us. Of course there were queers among us.
And that's one of the strongest paradoxes about politicizing sexuality. Because post-Stonewall, a lot of people that had been living discreet lives were outed and also, you know, called or made to believe that they had never done anything to address issues of rights and sexual orientation, when in reality they were actually doing a lot. They were living their lives in open ways, or not that open, but not politically.
Well, and this is actually, I mean, I'm glad you're raising this, because the next exhibition that I'm doing for Leslie Loveman is actually called Gay Politics Before Gay Identity. Mm-hmm. And what it is an exhibition of the interior of a home of a 96-year-old man, still alive, who was a ballet dancer and a set designer and a friend of a number of artists, has a major collection of the work of George Platt Lines, knew Lincoln Kirstein, on and on, right? And he, in his home, if you walked into his home, you would immediately go, oh my God, this is like such a gay interior. He has a ballet room, for example, with all the tokens of his ballet life. And what I realized, and the reason that I'm doing the show, is that this guy wanted the interior of his home to reflect an identity that was not in evidence outside the door of his house. When he was home, the walls were him. Outside, the world was a very different place. But notably, people came in and out of his house all the time. I mean, it was very clear to anybody visiting that he was queer. And he wanted it that way. That is the kind of gay politics that we've not credited. He ran a cafe in World War II as an officer behind enemy lines in China called Mama Greco's. Mama Greco was a large, hairy Italian who was universally known by the nickname Mama Greco, drag queen in World War II. These stories we don't get told. Of course, we don't get told them because we very rarely find our history reflected back to us.
Let us move on to the next chapter of your exhibition, Modernism. Can you address how you queer, or you provide a queer reading of the work made at the time?
What we really wanted to do, Modernism was, of course, in part about taking meaning out of its accepted channels, out of accepted notions of significance, and finding new forms for signifying. And sexuality and modernism thus ran very much a parallel track. I mean, literally, in that one of the artists who was credited with the development of abstraction in America very, very early, Marsden Hartley in 1914, creating works that we think of as the first abstract works, was in fact making complex pictorial addresses to the memory of a partner who had died, Carl von Freiburg, with all the images of Carl's military status embedded into the picture. In a way, of course, that allowed him to address Carl's life and his love for Carl without outing himself as being in love with a man and being in love with an enemy, or what would soon become an enemy with the advent of the First World War. And so Modernism then became one of those vocabularies that allowed forms of new address in which significance could teeter between pure formal play and something else. And a number of artists took advantage of the possibilities of new formal play to embed or encode work with other kinds of meanings, readable to a much smaller group. And people find this very strange, this idea that painting can speak to different audiences, or works of art can speak to different audiences at the same time. But we readily acknowledge that couples can have a private language that they use in public. One finds multiple competencies in reading works of art at different levels of audience. And artists played with that quite subconsciously. In fact, I think much more aware of those different levels than we are today, because there were real circumstances associated with them. If you got caught sending a work in the mail that was read as queer, you could be jailed for it.
Can you speak about the reading that you have done of Agnes Martin's work in
sure.
regards to this conversation? Because I think maybe it's a good example of what you're talking about.
Sure. I've been trying to excavate the sexuality of abstraction, because I felt that if queer studies was to have any kind of real cultural traction, it had to be able to make sense not only of images of bodies and of bodies in various forms of communion, but to actually address the question of abstraction itself. And Martin is a very curious instance, and in my exhibition I have an example of her female nudes from the 1940s. One of her lovers is represented. Martin aggressively tried to police this, just tried to destroy all those early works. They only survived because the lover kept them under the bed all those years after they broke up. Martin, when they finally entered the market, was going to buy them to destroy them, but died just in time. But the argument broadly about Martin is this, that what Martin was looking to do in her work was to suspend, this is very hard to put in succinct terms, but I'll give it a shot, was to suspend any idea of a given or naturalized category. Gay, lesbian, painting, drawing, any singular or stable world in favor of a moment of pure immanence, of pure becoming. In Martin's work, the grids, right, make the work as vertical as it is horizontal, as painterly as it is linear, as stable as it is unstable. In other words, every single relationship that one can find in that work cannot be locked down to a significance, a value. And what I wanted to do was to say, what is the queer investment, and I think there is one, in creating a sphere in which all there is a notion of becoming, a valuelessness, or at least a world in which stable values are no longer at work. And Martin's work, that experience people have in front of it, is often talked about in terms of the sort of that the work seems to unravel or relay itself to you slowly, layer by layer. And that process of recovering the meaning in time is one ultimately that is a moment of suspension as well from all the other categories of life, that you're no longer aware of all the other ways in which life is simply given to you. So it's a moment of openness in a closed off, regulated world. And paradoxically, I think that's the kind of liberation that Martin understood as queer, where our idea of queer liberation at the post-Stonewall moment would have been to say, I'm gay, I'm proud, that's my banner. But for somebody like Martin, that would have been merely agreeing with a dominant idea of what to be gay or lesbian was, and claiming that category for yourself. Better, she said, to eliminate categorization in its entirety, to have simply becoming.
What would she have thought of this interpretation of her work? Would she have been okay with a queer reading of her art?
No, because of course, inbuilt as one of the irresolvable paradoxes of what I'm trying to do is to give a lesbian reading to a form of art making that sought to, in some sense, evaporate the very category of difference or any stable notion of identity. And that cuts to the core of the problem, Because what I've always done is that I believe in the queer revolution, but I approach it like a post-Stonewall gay guy. I'm interested in talking about sexuality. I'm interested in talking about peoples who have not necessarily been forthcoming about their sexuality, to use the old term, to outing people. Not purely because it's controversial to do so, because I think it reveals aspects and significances in their work that otherwise aren't available. Johns and Rauschenberg incorporate interpictorial conversations. Famous iconic paintings are conversations back and forth to one another. Unless we can read those conversations, we only get a part of what those paintings are about. But ultimately, I'm interested in what queerness holds, which is that we finally achieve a world where we don't categorize people according to sexual differences. But I think the way you achieve queerness, paradoxically, is through the most rigorous engagement with gayness. By that I mean that the more one talks about the import of sexual difference, the less important sexual difference will be. Because you will come to manifest, in so many different ways, commonality ahead of difference.
Oftentimes I hear from some of the people that I've interviewed that the more you claim that there is difference, the more you give food for thought that there is difference. And hence those the division between difference and not becomes irreconcilable.
And yet, you know, I saw what happened with Ellen DeGeneres coming out on television, which for me is a locus classicus of all of this, because there was all of this sort of 8 months of build-up about Ellen DeGeneres's, is she going to come out? Is she not going to come out? Finally, she signals that she's going to say make a statement. Everybody's like, well, is she going to say she's a lesbian? Is she going to say she's bisexual? You know, it was so tiring. And then she says it, and everybody goes, ah, she finally claimed. And it was the first famous person, right, to say they're queer on television. Now, you say you're queer on television, nobody gives a shit. Ah, you're queer on television. Glee, Modern Family, number of shows have inbuilt queer roles. Nobody cares. What happened is that once we were able to get over, right, the discursive recognition that of course there are queers on television, because there, of course, there are queers everywhere.
Except it is acceptable to be queer or have a, or present queer characters in television shows that are intended as entertainment. But for example, in the case of Anderson Cooper, who is unofficially gay and out, were he to come out on television, he would probably not be able to continue doing his job.
I'm not sure,
you
actually.
Think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that's Anderson Cooper's fault. I think there would be a brouhaha, and, you know, assholes like Rush Limbaugh would try to make political hay out of it, of course. But you tell them to fuck off, and you go on. And Anderson Cooper, I mean, my God, everybody knows. You know, it's sort of Ricky Martin syndrome. You know, it's like, ah, she finally said so. So, I'm not convinced of that. In fact, I think we have to start recognizing that what we're talking about is not knowledge and lack of knowledge, but knowledge and acknowledgement. Everybody knows. Right, so it's just a question of acknowledging. It's articulating what everybody already knows.
Let me return to this chronology that we were going, because there's something that interests me very much, is your reading of John Cage and the contemporaries, Jasper Johns and Rauschenberg, and this idea of using chance and silence and coding, and then your recoding of this chance and silence and all of these strategies as a form of resistance. Can you address this this time period and how you're reading these people's works?
Sure. I mean, the dominant way that if anybody ever took, you know, sort of a queer studies approach to these figures in the first place, and they haven't very often been approached from a queer studies perspective, was to mark out the degree to which essentially it made a certain kind of sense for a closeted gay man like John Cage to make silence the touchwork of his aesthetic. And my thinking began around that problem, because I thought, no, that's not the way the closet operates. If you're in the closet, you want to be seamless. You don't want to be seen as hiding anything or being silent about something, because the point of the silent, right, of the closet is to ape perfectly dominant culture. And yet, John Cage is not aping dominant culture when he makes 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence, his famous all silent work. He's actually performing an act of silence. And so in this sense then, silence becomes not just a passive act, but an act of engagement, a kind of engagement with the notion of silencing. And through that, and similar readings, what I've tried to do is to say, yes, they're not political according to our understanding about politics, but they are discursively trying to make work that addresses, in the most general terms, right, their sexuality and their identity.
That injects a kind of reading of subjectivity in the work that was supposedly and presented and traditionally presented as formal work. Right?
Absolutely, and this is one of the things that really gets to me. You're absolutely right. There is a kind of policing action around the entire cohort that says this work is purely formal. It is, in fact, as founding postmodernist documents, about the death of the author, the devolving of signification onto an audience. Mm-hmm. Well, no one's ever stopped to say, why is it that everybody who is interested in devolving signification onto an audience, why is it that all the people who bespeak the death of the author, all those who profoundly claim that they cannot and do not express, were queer? Because if you look at Roland Barthes, Foucault, Johns, Rauschenberg, Cage, figures like John Ashbery in poetry, on and on and on, right? The key, indeed, I would argue, overwhelming, predominant founding figures of this discourse are people for whom the articulation of an authorial voice was, right, deeply problematic, precisely because of homophobia. And so let's think about the social historical origins of something which, of course, wants very much to claim that it has no social historical origins, but is merely a recognition of the way works of art operate. Well, I'm too much of a social historian to play that game. And the paradoxical result is that when I talk about the social history of postmodern theory, I am often accused of being ignorant of postmodern theory because postmodern theory mitigates against the discussion of its own social historical origins. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't care. Precisely because I think if we are to address the social origins of this, we will come to see how influential the particular politics around gay life were at that moment in its founding. In fact, I'm teaching a course called Post-War Postmodern this semester, which is broadly a reading of exactly that moment and queerness as its motor force.
What is happening parallelly in popular culture at the time in which these works of high art are being made and conceived? Is there a relationship between the work of Cage and those of the cabaret and the things that are happening outside?
It's actually very interesting. There isn't a relationship in formal terms at all, but there is a profound relationship. And the profound relationship, again, turns on the denial of the authorial. Because this is a cultural moment that sees the rise of an entire popular literature. For example, one representative work is called The Organization Man by William White, a best-selling work of 1956, in which White basically says that whereas the old model of the American was an inner-directed frontiersman, somebody who, in contravention to received wisdom and even, you know, the family back east, went west, reinvented himself, decided how he was going to live his life according to his own standards, deeply internalized. And then, he says, White says in this book, that image of the American became supplanted by the organization man. Somebody who achieves power within an organization and learns to mobilize power by a kind of repeated social camouflage so that they become one thing to their boss, they become another person to the person below them. They learn to perform or mobilize multiple identities. And this is in evidence across popular culture at this time, this idea, not, needless to say, without roots in the Cold War itself, this idea of multiple personalities, multiple faces, the man in the gray flannel suit, on and on. I could give you hundreds of examples of this. Well, why am I going into this? Precisely because what this suggests is that at the very moment that popular culture is invested in the idea of an identity that is mobile and multiple and not singular, so too, right, is postmodernism making that claim, and these early artists. So we have a moment in which a queer subjectivity and a straight dominant subjectivity traveled a parallel track. And that's really what I want to sort of explore at this moment, why it makes it so interesting that queers, long accustomed to domination, knew best how to give it formal language.
What about dance? Because I think, and I mean, if we can bring in Merce Cunningham into this one, do you think it's a similar development, or is there a space within dance as art that allows for a certain kind of opening and expression of the body differently?
Merce was really very much interested. I think it's, you know, it depends. There was a reaction to Merce, precisely because, as one of his dancers once put it to me, I got tired of being meat on stage. I wanted to be a person. I wanted to have a subjectivity, he was saying. But no, early on, Merce was very much about this. I'll give you an example. Merce had a problem with the development of chance operations in giving stage directions. Because how do you tell a dancer which way to turn without authorizing the audience, right, the front of the stage, the way unproblematically we have traditionally said it, as the center? And of course, Merce doesn't want to have centers. And he doesn't want to establish or instate lines of authority. So how do you tell a dancer to turn if you don't make the audience, right, the center? And he came up with the idea that the center, or forward, was wherever the dancer was then facing. So instead of making forward the audience, it was always keyed. And so different dancers had different forwards at different, you know, moments in the dance. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful metaphor for what Merce was trying to do, but it's also a political allegory, as so much of this work is. If there's no center, then it's not possible to be at the margins. And that also is part of what this work is about.
I think we're close to Stonewall, right?
Yeah.
How do you, what is the representation of Stonewall and this time in the exhibition at the National Portrait Gallery?
We wanted to decenter the idea that in 1969 something began, and instead make clear that in 1969 something achieved discursive form that had been coming together for almost 20 years. There is a series of works in the exhibition, two in particular that I point out, by one by Paul Cadmus and the other one by California artist Jess, that take the earlier politics of the exhibition with its interwoven and interconnected relationship of queer and straight, and makes very clear a kind of division, a boundaryness in emergence. Jess, for example, in 1951, very early on, cuts out a series of nudes from posing strap magazines and makes an entire figure, a collage out of those nudes, itself posing. And that figure is posing in a mirror, and the mirror is made out of clowns' heads. And there's a noose at the bottom of the mirror. And the work is called The Mouse's Tale, after Lewis Carroll's The Mouse's Tale. And literally, the noose ends with the last lines of Carroll's The Mouse's Tale from Alice in Wonderland, and they go like this. No need for a trial. I'll be the judge. I'll be the jury. I'll try the case, and I'll sentence you to death. So here you have an instance in which Jess is very clearly saying, you know, the world in which we find ourselves reflected sentences us without even any vestige of justice. And that's a very different politics in 1951 from the 1917 painting by George Bellows. Mm. And similarly, in 1948, Paul Cadmus does a work in which he basically cleaves gay from straight. It's called What I Believe, because in 1938, Smelling the Winds of War, E.M. Forster writes an essay called What I Believe, in which he asks how is basically Western culture to survive the coming conflagration? What's going to happen to art, to literature, to music, to the high points of our Western tradition? And he says, I believe they'll be preserved due to the offices, the good offices, of an aristocracy of the sensitive. And he said, these elite are not the historical elite, but they are those chosen through sensitivity. How do you know them? Well, they catch each other's eye in the street. They know who each other are. Right, so it becomes very clear what he's talking about as he talks about this sensitive crew. 10 years later, after, you know, World War II and its mass destruction, Cavus realizes that vision by creating a gay side of the picture, which is all about art and beauty. He puts all of the people that he is lovers with or that he's friends with, Lincoln Kirstein, his lover Jared French, etc., Ian Forster himself, in that side of the painting. And on the other side of the painting, he puts Hitler, Stalin, and Mussolini raining destruction and death. And he says, look, straight people kill Western civilization, queer people keep it going. And the reason I find that really interesting is because 15, 20 years earlier, we were talking about one American life. Mm. And now we're talking about these two communities, each of which have given an essentialized social role, right? And that becomes, right, finally, well, that was in 1948, Stonewall's in 1969, 21 years later. 21 years later, that politics achieves a kind of discursive profile in Stonewall, that there are these two communities.
What is the role of photography in post-Stonewall or in Stonewall and afterwards in asserting these kind of identities? I mean, I guess that the influx of documentary-based work, this type of documentary narratives that are created, assert a different way of understanding sexuality?
Yes. I mean, one of the things that's very interesting about photography, of course, is its claim to indexicality. And that offers a lot of room for political and social work and play that is exploited by artists of this period. It's also notable how early on many photographers, Mapplethorpe perhaps most notably, also use photography to force attention to things that people prefer not to see. I mean, I always think of Mapplethorpe as the great framer, because so much of that work isn't more than, in some sense, building a kind of, you have to see this frame around something that everybody knew existed, but preferred not to notice or to avert their eyes from. Mm. What's interesting is that that politics of claiming a particular perspective very quickly mutates into, and I've always struggled with the term for this, but I'm just going to call it a kind of poetic postmodernism, in which instead of expressive photography articulating a photographer's personal perspective a la Mapplethorpe, where Mapplethorpe is very clearly articulating, this is my culture, this is what I believe, this is what I value, artists are appropriating the language of postmodernism, seriality, appropriation, anti-authoriality, so it looks like they're not the author of their own works, they're not making any political statement, there's nothing expressive. And yet, if we look at those works, we find that they're curiously interested in appropriating, for example, earlier queer work. There are many different ways in which they're available to queer readings. And I find that very interesting, because what it suggests is the degree to which contemporary queer work doesn't want to claim gayness as the exclusive vector for reading or understanding the work, but it certainly doesn't want to exclude it either. And it has found a way to allow queerness to emerge alongside other frames of reference towards the interpretation of the work.
But in the case of Mapplethorpe, queerness is one of its most essential readings.
What Mapplethorpe does is, if you will, in the hierarchy of significance of that work, he makes queerness elevated. It's near the top. You can say a lot of things about the work's formal terms, all of that's true, but you can't get over the fact that its queerness quotient is very, very high. Mm. These other figures are interested in taking that quotient down, not to the point of, and you know, we've tended to say that if you bring the queerness down, you're closeting it. It's not towards closeting it, I think. Rather, it's to bring other things up so that queerness is integrated into the work, not as its raison d'être, but as something that is part of it, the way it is part of the artist, the way it is part of life.
And who are these other figures, for example?
Jim Hodges is a good example of such a figure. And what Jim Hodges is doing, not exactly photography, he's doing sort of mostly installation painting, but some photography. What Jim is doing is, you know, in some instances, he's riffing on the work of Felix Gonzalez Torres. He's creating works that allow richly, evocatively queer meaning. They play with the notion of handicraft, feminine-coded work. Famously, he builds a gigantic curtain out of plastic flowers that he sews together. So it has the floral element, it has handicraft, it has femininely coded structures. And yet, of course, one can read that in queer terms as a dissident, but one doesn't have to. One could also see it's a pretty curtain made out of plastic flowers.
I want to go back a few years because I want to ask you your perspectives on the relationship between the feminist revolution and the sexual revolution and the kind of art that is produced throughout the 70s. And what is this something that is addressed in the exhibition? What are your interests in that regard?
I bring out work associated with lesbian separatism because I think that we have rewritten the history of the queer movement to not articulate this slightly embarrassing historical moment when women felt necessary to exclude themselves exclusively from a dominant, male-dominated society and create their own culture. Of course, we fully recognize and indeed celebrate male separatism in all sorts of different angles, right? Universities in the United States were male separatist bastions. Yale didn't let women in until 1968. So male separatism, of course, is an unmarked category. But female separatism we get very upset about. And so one of the things is that we have tended not to talk about it. Well, there were a number of photographers who worked out of a separatist idiom and who wanted to make photography, including erotic photography, that spoke about women's relationships with women to the exclusion of men. And there is a section of the exhibition that talks about this. But more broadly, what I think a lot of the work initially in the 70s around feminism tended to be framed by critics like Douglas Crimp, Craig Owens, in ways that minimized its social historicity. So that Sherry Levine, in photographing historical works of photography and making those works her own, is understood as engaging in an act of appropriation in which her gender is of no significance. The fact that the artists that she is photographing are men doesn't enter the picture, right? Gender is abstracted away. And so this becomes, she speaks in all of our voice, and Cindy Sherman's photography and Barbara Kruger's political critique are in some sense attempts to re-engage a question of feminist critique, which these queer male critics, Crimp, Owens, right, didn't see. And again, Crimp's a beautiful example of the shifts that AIDS generated discursively. And indeed, my next show, which is called Art AIDS America, is profoundly about this moment, about what happens to the death of the author when authors actually start to die. And what it happens is that somebody like Douglas Crimp comes to recognize that the very orthodox postmodernist terms of his engagement, anti-authoriality, seriality, appropriation, all that stuff about losing the hand and the touch of the artist, of course, fits in beautifully, is in perfect sync with a culture that doesn't want to see queerness, doesn't want to hear queerness. Mm. And AIDS makes manifest to him the necessity of violating that orthodox postmodernism and bringing back an idea of community, of culture, of history. of meaning in its old sense of expressive intent back into art.
How is this period represented in the exhibition, The AIDS Crisis?
I do a lot with works by people like Wanarovich, some works by artists like Felix Gonzalez Torres, Mapplethorpe, who else is there? There's a beautiful work by A.A. Bronson of his partner minutes after he had died, of billboard scale, to address precisely the politics that one wants to avert one's eyes at the specter of death. It was in 1987 that the president's spokesperson said, Reagan's spokesperson said, that there was no evidence that AIDS was spreading into the general population. I remember sitting at home thinking, well, what the fuck does that make me? And that was the frame, right? And then A. Bronson does this thing, says, you can't avert your eyes. You have to see this. There's somebody else in the show, Jerome Kaya, who makes works. He sort of adopted a kind of bad drag queen persona and made work out of nail polish as paint. And in this work, in the exhibition, as several other works, he uses the ashes of his best friend Charles as the ground for the work. And you turn it over and it says on the other side, bitch, I told you I'd be in an exhibition before you. And there's that kind of graveyard humor that only people who've been subjected to, you know, real trauma engage.
Speak about the culture of war in relationship to the recent removal of Wojana Rawicz's Fire in My Belly of the exhibition. Is this an echo of what happened in the early 80s?
Yeah.
Can you locate kind of comparatively?
Really, it's really interesting. I mean, in some sense, it's totally different. Not least because, of course, in 1989, when that show was killed, there was an outcry within the art world, but it was very much focal and delimited to sort of exceptional, you know, community-based galleries and things like that. Fundamentally, there wasn't much going on. Now, I mean, I'm struck by the fact that almost every day I'm getting a phone call from one museum or another, someplace in the globe, saying, we're showing the film, what do we need to know about it? So there really has been, and that's, of course, enabled by electronic media in a way that wasn't available in 1989.
Why didn't they show it before?
Well, that's the very good question, right? And that's always the question I kind of want to ask. And, of course, I'm also very much worried that now that they're showing the video, they will be able to claim that they gave it the office and queerness will not be part of their regular exhibition program because they already did that, which, of course, is ridiculous. But to answer your question directly, like 1989, this is not about art. In a profound way, it's not even about sexuality. It is about politics. And what we're seeing the right do, yet again, is to politicize the question of representation, because fundamentally, that is the right's agenda. The right, as all ideologues claim, wants to supplant a notion of a pluralistic, multiple democracy with an idea of a singular vision, dominated, of course, exclusively by their perspective. They want to supplant discourse, right, with mere agitprop. And to look back, to look away from the president, look back to a realm of surety in which their particular ethnic grouping was unquestionably dominant. And that vision of America is, thank God, dead, except there. But they are doing their best to use representation, the politics of representation, to, we believe, bring us back to small town America and its fictive constructs, and to thereby solder an increasingly fragmented movement around an America that never was.
What do you think will be the effects in the long run of this censorship again? regarding the visibility of queer culture, the parallel between what's happening in popular culture versus art, and the possibility of presenting this type of exhibition in government-sponsored institutions?
Well, it's a very complicated question. Let me first say that it's not without meaning that this exhibition took place at the Smithsonian, not at a large private museum. Let's face it, the Met, MoMA, the Whitney, they could have done this exhibition. They wouldn't have given a damn what Congress had to say. They are much freer than a federal installation. And yet, ironically, it was a federal museum that sought to break the boycott, not one of New York's great, supposedly leading institutions.
By the boycott, you mean?
Basically, the blacklisting on sexuality since Mapplethorpe. The fact that here we are in 2011 and my shows is the first major queer show. It's kind of ridiculous. Years after queerness is fairly much in evidence in the realms of music and film and television and other power centers in American life. And yet the museum world, which understands itself as progressive and is credited as such, is now behind international banking in its political openness. And what worried me was that a social and political gesture, which was intended to ultimately kill the blacklist, has at least now the distinct prospect of having reinvigorated it. It's funny. We'll see in the next couple of years whether or not this show had its intended effect. But it's created so much Sturm und Drang that I'm not entirely clear whether a museum will take sexuality under consideration. In this sense, the right did what they wanted. I mean, they got what they wanted out of this. They want pages, they want commentary, they want to sort of make themselves central to definitions of culture. And that they've done. And now, when we make exhibitions about ourselves, we necessarily must reference or address them. Any museum proposal that goes forward now is going to have to talk about what happens when the Catholic League attacks. Now, the Catholic League is, you know, six people who sit in pajama bottoms in the basement of their house, doubtless masturbating to pornography when they're not attacking us. But that doesn't matter. They've achieved this, not on their own, let's be clear, but because a Republican leadership jumped into bed with them, and a Republican leadership jumped into bed with them as a means of appealing to a Tea Party base.
To what extent do you think this controversy is caused by issues of sexual orientation as opposed to a kind of what could be understood as a disrespect of religion? Because I understand that the scene, the infamous scene, is the one with the ants crawling over Jesus Christ, correct?
Yeah.
Is it so much about sex, or is it much more about religion?
You know, it's supposed to be about religion. But anybody who's ever looked at a Baroque altarpiece knows that the most orthodox history of Christian art understands the degree to which the image of Christ becomes an allegory of human suffering. That's not new. It's ancient. And so the idea that somehow this is disrespectful to Christianity is bullshit, and they know it.
It's the larger framework, then.
It is the larger framework. Ultimately, the show is up for a month before they attacked. I would not be surprised if they did focus groups, trying to find a way to get it. Now, paradoxically, this is a certain form of progress, because in the old days, you simply had to say, there's a queer, go kill it. And it did the work it needed to do. Mm. They can't do that anymore. They can't just be nakedly homophobic. So they find new ways of getting it. And of course, in America, at least, religious offense, and the discourse of religious offense, by the way, which is our discourse, hate speech, they called it, that's the language we've used. They've appropriated it. So they've taken our strategies and they've used them against us. But let's also recognize that in the final analysis, again, it's not about religion, to be sure. It's not even about our sexuality. It's just about gaining power. It's about playing, right, the old game of divide and conquer and building your base by in common hating all of them And that's, of course, that's a cynical, hateful, anti-American politics that has moved alongside other American political developments since the founding of this country. And it continues to deliver, which is why they do it. Old habits die hard.
I'm interested in whether it is a coincidence at all that it is Wojan Orobic's piece that is removed from the exhibition. The relationship between the mode of production and the strategies that these artists at this time were using as a form of resistance, activism, personal expression, whatnot, in relationship to the way that queer artists are working today. Can you speak about that?
Absolutely. I mean, Wojnarowicz very much understood the options for his work discursively to be pretty much binary at this moment of Jesse Helms and widespread homophobia in the art world. On one hand, you could produce work like Felix Gonzalez Torres, which acted, and he uses this term self-consciously, virally within the museum system, to escape censors, to speak queerness within the institution in ways that are illegible to those who refuse to hear it. Or you could be like Wojnarowicz, where you are a directly aggressive political activist. Wojnarowicz would be in no way surprised that he is the subject of this controversy, nor was Mapplethorpe. Would have been surprised to find the perfect moment pulled. It was part of the point of that work, to be aggressively political in a legible, forward sense. Mm-hmm. I think he may be surprised that his work is still tendentious today, but I think, again, he would have understood the particular irony that they couldn't attack the work face forward on its queerness, and so had to use the ruse of religious freedom. I also think that we're at a moment, a curious cultural moment, in which this poetic postmodernism rules the roost, and more aggressively political work tends to be given or accorded very little respect, as an emblem of a too essentializing, old school political investment. One that, in mentioning the category that it seeks to contest, is unaware of how powerfully it reinscribes that category as central. And I think that that's a misunderstanding of a kind of political work today. And I am very much interested in forward queer art, even as I'm also interested in poetic postmodernism. When something assimilates itself too easily to the market, I begin to get nervous.
I think there is a relationship between the way that artists are working today with the boom of the market, and I think it's inseparable. Because the market will not tolerate for this straightforward political critique, yes, that was so present in a time of crisis, and what perhaps was perhaps the only way to voice the urgency of the moment. It seems like right now gay politics are in a moment of normalization, in the sense that the fight is not life or death, but is the idea of being
marriage,
able to get married or not, and things like
war.
This.
Yeah.
What is the work that gets produced within this paradigm of normalization, when there is not really an urgency? What are queer artists working on today?
It's really interesting. I mean, you see a lot of work that's about normalization, that essentially embraces the idea of queerness by playing with the prospect of mutability. Either in gender terms or in erotic terms, that one can seamlessly occupy positions that would have been called gay and straight, or male and female, things that were opposed together. And so that's one of the things that one sees. It's also really interesting to me how many of the aesthetics of resistance or dissidence in the work are now reanimating punk modes. and other historical modes of dissonance to speak in queer terms today. What I'm missing is that there's now a kind of orthodoxy, paradoxically, to queerness, that which was intended to be unorthodox, whereby under queerness, right, you really don't want to claim any kind of essentializing identity, you don't want to claim any kind of essentializing history. How do I put this? There are gay artists who aren't invested in queerness because they don't care or understand it. But there are also queer, post-queer artists who are interested in exploring the limitations of that of the queer discursive frame from a position that well understands what that politics was able to proffer and was unable to see.